Here we're beginning the lesson of Lot, our first one. So we're looking at Genesis 12 and 13. I see that for us there are two ways in life. There's God's way, but there's also the world's way. And even as Christians, we can try and combine the two, which doesn't work very well. God has a highway that he talks about in Isaiah 35:8. And I think of it as a high way. That's his way. But by our foolishness, how often do we deliberately turn off of it for something that we want to do or have, or drift off of it by not staying close to him? The world's way beckons with temptations, and we're tempted to be what we want to be. There's always a pride involved there, to do what we want to do. We want to do our own thing. And we want to have what we want to have, possessions and the pleasures of this world. The marvellous thing is that if we do drift or deliberately move off of God's highway, the minute we turn back to him, he is willing to enable us to come back. And he's there with open arms, like he was with the prodigal, such as his grace. I met a lady called Stella at a lay witness mission years ago, and this was her testimony. She was a Christian, she was a believer, a churchgoer, but her stumbling block and the thing that had taken her off the highway was an heirloom teapot. That in her family, this old teapot, which did have some value, when the mother died, went to one of the two girls. She was the older one. She said she should have it. Her younger sister said, "Mum actually promised it to me," but Stella got it. And it caused such a rift in the family that those two sisters and their families just separated. But what Stella said was her life with the Lord somehow went downhill, and she never had the joy, she never had that something that other people seem to have in their walk with the Lord. So she went to a lay witness mission, and this was a question that they always asked: what hinders you from a full commitment to Jesus Christ? What will you not give up or change? Well, teapot went straight through her, you know, like a shaft of light, and she had to choose whether she would hold on to it or let it go. She chose to let it go. And in the end, it meant a full restoration in the family. But more than anything else, it meant for her a new walk with the Lord that she had not had for so, so long. And so she was one of the people at the lay witness mission who was given testimony. She became part of the team. Now, the main character in Genesis 12, right through to chapter 24 to 25, is Abraham. But in these sessions, we're going to focus mainly on Abraham's nephew Lot. We can learn a lot from Lot, but we will start with Abraham, and that's a fair bit of today. In chapters 12 to 16 of Genesis, his name is Abraham. But in Genesis 17, when God confirms the covenant promises of a seed, that is of the Messiah, who will come through him and Sarah, and of nations that will come through them, their names are changed. There is an H added to each of the names. Now, the word for breath or spirit in the Hebrew is ruhah, and the ha is like breathing. And so as that breath of God is given to them in a special way, they become Abraham and Sarah instead of Sarai. Now, it hadn't happened in this passage of Genesis 12 and 13, but sometimes if we say Abraham or Abram, we know we're talking about the same person. Abram came from the city of Ur, and it was a highly developed city, architecturally magnificent, a great ziggurat there with the worship of the moon god Nana and the moon goddess Ningal, a very, very pagan city. It was situated in Chaldea. Now, that's today is southern Iraq, and it has different names, whether it's Sumer, then Chaldea, then Babylonia, and so on down through the ages. But this is where Ur is. It's on the River Euphrates, and fairly well south of Babel. And we know that Abraham's family was a family of idolaters, because we're told in Joshua 24:2, Joshua said, "This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. Long ago, your forefathers, including Terah, the father of Abraham and Nahor, lived beyond the river," that is the Euphrates, "and worshipped other gods. But I took Abraham from the land beyond the river and led him throughout Canaan." Of course, he led him to Canaan. Now, out of that highly civilized and wealthy environment, God laid his hand upon Abraham, and we haven't got a record of exactly what happened at that time, except that he was called out, and he was called to go to a land unknown to him. Now, when you've had everything in a high civilization and you're called to go out, missionaries know about this, it's not a very easy thing necessarily. So he was being called to separate from the corruption of the world around him. He was being called to be a sojourner in Canaan. For the rest of his life, he would live in tents, not in what he'd had. And he would be a pilgrim on earth rather than a citizen of Ur. And that's how it is with us. You know, this isn't our home. This isn't our permanent home. We are just pilgrims here. And so Abraham left Ur together with his father Terah and his nephew Lot. And Genesis 11:31 says, I've preceded it, "Terah took his son Abraham, his grandson Lot," because Lot's dad was dead, "and his daughter-in-law Sarai, and together they set out from Ur of the Chaldeans to go to Canaan. But when they came to Haran, they settled there." And Terah is very interesting. He seems to be one who has an influence. He's the patriarch of the family. But Terah's name means delay. And so they moved upriver and settled there for apparently quite a while. So Abraham did not fully obey God in that first move, because God said, leave your family and move out. But Terah died in Haran, and then again Abraham moved out. God called him again. But it reminds me of the man who said to Jesus, I'll come and follow you, but first let me bury my father. By which he meant, when my father dies, I'll be free to come and follow you. And Jesus said to him, let the dead bury the dead. You come and follow me. And so we know that God actually comes before family. That comes as a shock to many people. They think that's terrible. What they do not understand is when God comes first, that is when the family is blessed. And that is when God has the freedom, as it were, that we allow for him to work in their lives. How many here can talk about the time when they surrendered the family over to God, and what a blessing that turns out to be, even though for some you may have to wait. So now Abraham moves, and chapter 12, verse 1, the Lord, notice it says the Lord had said to Abraham, leave your country, your people, and your father's household, and go to the land I will show you. I will make you into a great nation. I'll bless you. I'll make your name great. You will be a blessing. I'll bless those who bless you. Whoever curses you, I'll curse. And all peoples on earth will be blessed through you. And of course, it is through Abraham that the Messiah, the Saviour of the world, from whom all blessings flow, that comes through his line. So Abraham left as the Lord had told him, and Lot went with him. Abraham was 75 years old. Don't know how old Lot was. And he took his wife Sarai, his nephew Lot, all the possessions they had accumulated, so they're still quite wealthy, and they set out for the land of Canaan, and they arrived there. Not a single word about the journey, going around the Fertile Crescent, or from, if you're looking at going from the Euphrates River and up and around and coming down into Canaan, because between there's desert, so you don't cut across the middle there. Abraham travelled through the land as far as the site of the great tree of Moreh at Shechem. At that time the Canaanites were in the land. The Lord appeared to Abraham and said, "To your offspring I will give this land." So he built an altar there to the Lord who had appeared to him. From there he went on towards the hills east of Bethel and pitched his tent with Bethel on the west and Ai, or some say Ai, on the east. There he built an altar to the Lord and called on the name of the Lord. And then Abraham set out and continued towards the Negev. He was going south. I think it's interesting that it says that he pitched his tent with Bethel on one side on the west and Ai on the east. Bethel means house of God. Ai means ruin. And in a way, you know, that's the middle. We can choose either the house of God or we can choose ruin, whichever we want. Now, Abraham, being this tent dweller, what he built were altars of worship to the Lord, of praise. He had things to learn. He did learn. But his faith grew. He stumbled, just as we do, and he learned from some of those things. But the principle here, you might have had it before, is the altered life is the altered life. When you're going to God to worship, to the altar, as it were, then he alters your life. So Hebrews 11:8-10 is lovely. It says, "By faith Abraham, when called to go to a place he would later receive as his inheritance, obeyed and went, even though he did not know where he was going. By faith he made his home in the promised land like a stranger in a foreign country. He lived in tents, as did Isaac, who was his son who would come, and Jacob, his grandson, who were heirs with him of the same promise." This is the good verse. "For he was looking forward to the city with foundations, whose architect and builder is God, as are we." Now, you know that our house, Devon's and mine, the family house, is going back on the market after having been on the market and nothing has happened. And where we and the family will live next, we have no idea. We cannot do anything until we have sold to have any idea what resources or where or what. And we are trusting God, and he knows we are leaning on him. But despite that, we get the wobblies about things when you have no idea and there are children and so on involved in this. But it was a much bigger move for Abraham. And God is good in that he speaks to me at these times by the very lessons we have on the day about that. So Abraham had entered Canaan. Entering Canaan is not going to heaven, though some of our hymns give you that idea. It's entering the new life here that God gives when you become one of his, receiving first part of inheritance on earth. But there are battles and tests that go on in Canaan, enemies to fight and so on. But before long, Abraham faced a test in Canaan. And as someone said, sometimes it takes more faith to stay in Canaan than it did to get there. And there are those of us who know it was easier to answer a call that God gave to come to him than to go on and on with what he has in front of us. And we can easily lose our first love. Verse 10. "Now there was a famine in the land, and Abraham went down to Egypt to live there for a while because the famine was severe." This is the first biblical mention of Egypt in the Bible, and it symbolizes alliance with the world. Egypt, like Ur, had many wonders, great idolatry. It was a time of the pyramids, enormous building, but a very pagan place. Now, Abraham went from faith to fear. He went out of Canaan, where God had called him, into the world for help. Boyce, James Montgomery Boyce, likes to paint a scenario that would have been so much better for Abraham. He says this, that suppose a servant came and said to Abraham, there's food and fodder for 7 days only. And Abraham said, well, hand out a seventh. And then there's food and fodder for 3 days only. Well, hand out a third. And then there's only enough for one day. Well then, hand it out. God doesn't abandon those who trust him right to the end. And those of you who know the George Mueller story know how he fed a growing orphanage of children there in Bristol by trusting God to provide for him. And God never failed, even though at the beginning of things there were times when the breakfast plates were empty, the children were seated, grace was said, and after that the milk and bread arrived at the door. But Abraham went to the world for help. He went to Egypt, but he feared the Egyptians also. So he was just going from the frying pan of famine into the fire of Egypt. And as I said, you go up to Jerusalem and down to Egypt. The significance of those words is no coincidence. Verse 11, as he was about to enter Egypt, he said to his wife Sarai, I know what a beautiful woman you are. When the Egyptians see you, they will say, this is his wife. Then they will kill me, but will let you live. Say you are my sister, so that I'll be treated well for your sake, and my life will be spared because of you. Now, most commentators say that Abraham probably expected, should someone desire to have Sarah, that marriage arrangements and a settlement would have to be made that would give him some time to make an escape. But as one of the Youth for Christ leaders used to say often, never replace faith with scheming. And how often do we work very hard to try and make the things we think work out rightly, instead of going to God? Abraham had Sarah agree to tell a half-truth. She was his wife, but she was also his half-sister. They had the same father, but different mothers. That was not a genetic problem, as it would be today, when our gene pool now has become so much more flawed that if there were children born of close blood relationship, those genetic flaws are passed on with disease or disability. It was not the case then. But Abraham's plans went wrong. Sarah was taken into Pharaoh's harem. Verse 14, when Abraham came to Egypt, the Egyptians saw that she was a very beautiful woman. And when Pharaoh's officials saw her, they praised her to Pharaoh, and she was taken into his palace. He treated Abraham well for her sake, and Abraham acquired sheep, cattle, male and female donkeys, men servants, maid servants, and cattle. There were no negotiations with Pharaoh. He takes as it pleases him. Now, Abraham was certainly getting materially richer, but Sarah was at risk of being called into Pharaoh's bed, and the whole promise of a coming nation through Sarah and Abraham and of a coming Messiah put at risk. But God moved. God was not pleased to have Sarah placed in such a position to be used as Abraham's shield. In fact, later, when Abraham's back in fellowship with God, God says to him, I am your shield and your very great reward. And he is our shield as well. We can't have any better protection than God himself in time of trouble. And Sarah was not to be used and put at risk of a violation against her own body, perhaps never being released once she'd gone to Pharaoh's bed. She was not to be, this is not God's plan, that a woman should be a sexual commodity. And so, in verse 17, the Lord inflicted serious diseases on Pharaoh and his household because of Abraham's wife Sarai. So Pharaoh summoned Abraham. What have you done to me? He said. Why did you tell me she was your wife? Why did you say, she is my sister, so that I took her to be my wife? Now then, here is your wife. Take her and go. How did Pharaoh discover the reason for the diseases rampant in the palace? Was it that Sarah spoke to other women and news got back to Pharaoh? Was it that the priests and the seers there, through their occultic practices, discovered by God's enabling what was happening? Did God speak to Pharaoh himself? However God did this, he ensured that Pharaoh knew the truth. And it's Pharaoh who's shown up in a better light here than Abraham. Abraham was meant to be a blessing. God had said to him, I will make you a blessing. But his disobedience turned him into a curse on Pharaoh. He was sent from Egypt in disgrace. Wearsby says this, a Christian husband out of the will of God can bring untold trouble to his wife and family. I believe so can a Christian wife or parent out of the will of God bring trouble. Well, verse 20, then Pharaoh gave orders about Abraham to his men, and they sent him on his way with his wife and everything he had. Now, we can ignore our mistakes. We can lose heart. We can get bogged down in a sense of failure. It's easy to feel, after one has really blown it and gone the wrong way, to get discouraged and feel that you're never going to do any better and keep on going down. Or we can learn and go on stronger and look to God, and not at our weaknesses, but always to him. Now, of course, there can be consequences, but it's the Lord who will help us through those, and he's so gracious. He will even use those for good, ultimately. So, chapter 13. So Abraham went up from Egypt to the Negev with his wife and everything he had, and Lot went with him. Abraham had become very wealthy in livestock and in silver and gold. So from Egypt, Abraham brought out problems. One, which we won't see in this study, but one was the Egyptian handmaid Hagar, who came out with them. And the problems that resulted from that are with us in the 21st century, where we have Isaac and Ishmael still at enmity and Arab against Jew. But Lot, having been brought up in idolatrous, sinful Ur, left his own country. He came with Abraham to Canaan. He participated. He wanted to do that in the Lord's promises, to worship him. He lived in tents. But in Egypt, he learned to love wealth as he again tasted the wealth, the world. And so he would have seen, too, Uncle Abraham use deception rather than turning to God to handle something that he feared. Abraham failed God, he failed Sarah, and he failed Lot. Abraham did learn from his experience. He went back to Bethel. He went back to the altar, and that's the word for us. If we've slipped, go back to the place where we've been close to the Lord and look at him and talk with him and listen to him again. And that is what Abraham did at this time. So verse 3 of chapter 13, from the Negev he went from place to place until he came to Bethel, to the place between Bethel and Ai, where his tent had been earlier and where he had first built an altar. There Abraham called on the name of the Lord. But what about Lot? Now Lot, who was moving about with Abraham, also had flocks and herds and tents. The land couldn't support them while they stayed together. Their possessions were so great, so many animals to feed. And quarrelling arose between Abraham's herdsmen and the herdsmen of Lot. It says in verse 7, the Canaanites and Perizzites were also living in the land at that time. So these are the locals, these are the neighbours who watched to see these people who build altars to the Lord will deal with a difficult situation. Just as people watch Christians and watch those in the church to see how they will work out their differences and their problems. And sometimes it's a very sad thing that disgrace is brought on the name of the Lord because we have not learned how to work out those differences, and God will show us if only we are willing there. But Abraham said to Lot, "Let's not have any quarrelling between you and me or between your herdsmen and mine, for we are brothers." Now, Abraham was the senior. He was an uncle. But he says here in humility, "We are brothers." He says, "Is not the whole land before you? Let's part company. If you go to the left, I'll go to the right. If you go to the right, I'll go to the left." So Abraham's eyes are on the Lord. He doesn't have to scheme to protect his interests, and neither do we. But Lot was out of Egypt, but as they say, Egypt was not out of Lot. So verse 10, Lot looked up and saw that the whole plain of the Jordan was well watered, like the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt toward Zoar. This was before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. So Lot chose for himself the whole plain of the Jordan and set out toward the east. The two men parted company. I have a principle here, and it's this. The heart of the problem is in the heart. Lot had a bit of heart trouble at this time. And if we have a problem of any sort and we're working it out, have a look at the heart and see if there's a problem there. Where Lot lifted up his eyes, says the King James, or looked up, and he saw these lush plains of the lower Jordan. The Apostle John in 1 John 2:16 warns us about the lust of the eyes. We see something and then we want it. It's like the biscuit or the chocolate. If the cupboard door is shut, we are not tempted in the way that if it's right there in front of our eyes. And that's the success of advertising and the catalogues and so on that come in. We see something and we want to have it. And looking can lead to many sins, sexual sins included. And Satan loves to use our eyes because there's a battle going on. It's a war. But like the old hymn says, we're called to be Christian soldiers looking unto Jesus who has gone before. And when we look to him, he helps us when those temptations come. Our problem is very often that when we are tempted, we don't go to him for help because we don't want his help. We want to have the thing that we have seen. Like Lot. Lot wanted the wealth, the riches of the plains that he saw. John Wesley said, "The last part of a man to be converted is his wallet." So verse 12, Abraham lived in the land of Canaan while Lot lived among the cities of the plain and pitched his tents near Sodom. Now the men of Sodom were wicked and were sinning greatly against the Lord. But then, such is the way that God works and his grace. After Abraham's godly choice to let Lot choose, then, verse 14, the Lord said to Abraham, after Lot had parted from him, "Lift up your eyes from where you are. Look north, south, east and west. All the land that you see, I will give you and your offspring forever. I will make your offspring like the dust of the earth so they can't even be counted. Go walk through the length and breadth of the land, for I am giving it to you." So Abraham received this beautiful promise by faith. Now so much was in the future. Abraham was wealthy all his life and had all he needed, but he walked through this and believed in faith for all that God had promised that would come through him down the ages, and in doing so he came so close in relationship that he is called the friend of God. He moved his tents and went to live near the great trees of Mamre at Hebron, and there he built an altar to the Lord. And Lot? 2 Peter 2:7 tells us this, that God rescued righteous Lot. That's from the destruction of Sodom that we'll come to later. But he is called righteous. And it goes on, rescued righteous Lot, who was distressed by the filthy lives of lawless men among whom he lived day after day, tormented in his righteous soul by the lawless deeds he saw and heard. Lot had what he wanted, the wealth and the comfort of the world, but he didn't have any heart satisfaction. He was counted righteous because of his faith, because he believed that the Lord is God. He believed enough to leave his own country, but he had a foot in the world as well. And as Jesus said, you can't serve God and mammon. You can't serve God and the world. And many today, one lady said this, have enough Christianity to bug them and not enough to bless them. It stops that Christian from really enjoying the sins they're involved in, but they don't have any real relationship and lovely walk and satisfaction in the Lord either. Lot started out well, but after a stint in Egypt, says he looked towards Sodom, then moved towards Sodom, and as we'll see next time, he moved into Sodom. So we go bit by bit so often. Wordsworth said, the world is too much with us, late and soon, getting and spending. We lay waste our powers. We lay waste our lives. Never has there been such a consumer society as the one that we live in today. But eternity awaits us, and this time here we'll be just a blink by comparison. And Jesus said in Matthew 6:20, lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven. We don't know what they are, but they can never be destroyed, and they must be beyond our wildest imaginings in worth and in having. The only thing that you can take into heaven is your relationship with Jesus Christ. And while you're here, you can walk with him, as many of you do, and what a precious thing that is. But you can come closer and closer. How close to Sodom have you pitched your tent? Is there something for you to lay down before the Lord and come closer? In Matthew 7 verse 13, Jesus said, there is a broad way that many choose. It leads to destruction. And he said, there is a narrow way. That's the narrow way where you squeeze through the gate and you leave your old baggage behind. He says, few choose it. He said, he is the gate to that narrow way. And it leads to ever widening life. Amen.